Torn between wishful thinking and the mounting evidence, Stalin persisted in believing that a diplomatic breakthrough with Hitler was just round the corner, even though he now knew the date of Operation Barbarossa from his spymasters. When Stafford Cripps, the British ambassador, delivered a letter from Winston Churchill warning of the invasion, it backfired, convincing Stalin that Britain was trying to entrap Russia. He and Zhdanov repeatedly quoted Bismarck's sensible dictum that Germany should never face war on two fronts. Stalin persisted in believing that Hitler, the reckless gambler, was a rational Bismarckian great power statesman like himself. Military measures were agonizingly slow, so much so that the fortifications were unfinished when the onslaught came. Even Stalin's inner circle could smell war now. It was so pervasive that Zhdanov suggested they cancel the May Day parade in case it was too provocative. Stalin did not cancel it, but he placed Dekhanozov, the ambassador to Germany, right next to him on the mausoleum to signal his warmth towards Berlin. On the 4th of May, he sent another signal to Hitler that he was ready to talk. Stalin replaced Molotov as premier, promoting Zhdanov's protégé Nikolai Voznesensky, the brash economic maestro, as his deputy on the inner bureau. At 38, Voznesensky's rise had been meteoric, and this angered the others. Finally, Stalin prepared the military for the possibility of war. At a dinner for 2,000 officers, he made a speech praising the modern mechanization of his new army. Was the German army unbeatable? There are no invincible armies in the world. But war was coming. If Molotov can delay the start of war for 2 to 3 months, this'll be our good fortune. He gave a toast. Long live the dynamic offensive policy of the Soviet state. This was a relief to the military. Stalin was not living in cloud cuckoo land. The state was ready to fight. Or was it? The state was not sure. The magnates tried to steer a path between Stalin's infallibility and Hitler's reality. The absurdity of explaining how the army had to be ready to fight an offensive war which was definitely not going to happen, while claiming this was not a change of policy, was so ridiculous that they tied themselves in knots. On the 7th of May, Schulenburg, the German ambassador, secretly opposed to Hitler's invasion, breakfasted with Dekhanozov, whom he tried to warn. Dekhanozov informed Stalin, who was becoming ever more bad-tempered and nervous. "So, disinformation has now reached ambassadorial level," he growled. On the 10th of May, Stalin learned of Deputy Führer Hesse's quixotic peace flight to Scotland. His magnates were all understandably convinced that Hesse's mission was aimed at Moscow, but Stalin was finally willing to prepare for war, admittedly in a manner so timid that it was barely effective. On the 12th of May, Stalin allowed the generals to strengthen the borders, calling up 500,000 reserves, but was terrified of offending the Germans. When Timoshenko reported German reconnaissance flights, Stalin mused, "I'm not sure Hitler knows about those flights." Then paralysis struck again. Stalin refused to take any further measures. Intelligence was now flooding in. It was surely clear that something ominous was darkening the western border, yet on the 9th of June, when Timoshenko and Zhukov mentioned the array of intelligence, Stalin tossed their papers at them and snarled, "And I have different documents." He mocked Richard Zorge, the master spy in Tokyo, who used his amorous and sybaritic appetites to conceal his peerless intelligence gathering. "There's this bastard who set up factories and brothels in Japan and even deigned to report the date of the German attack as the 22nd of June. Are you suggesting I should believe him too?" Saturday, the 21st of June, was a warm and uneasy day in Moscow. By early evening, Stalin was deeply disturbed by the persistently ominous reports. He ordered Molotov to summon Schulenburg to protest about German reconnaissance flights and find out what he could. Meanwhile, Timoshenko telephoned to report that a German deserter had revealed the planned dawn invasion. Stalin swung between the force of reality and the self-delusion of his infallibility. In Molotov's office, Schulenburg was relieved to see that the foreign commissar was still oblivious to the scale of his country's plight. The Russian asked him why Germany seemed dissatisfied with their Soviet allies, and why had the women and children of the German embassy left Moscow. Not all the women, said Schulenburg. My wife is still in town. Molotov gave a resigned shrug of the shoulders and returned to Stalin's office. News arrived that a second deserter had warned that war would begin at 4 a.m. Well, what now? The pacing Stalin asked. There was silence. The Politburo sat like dummies. Timoshenko raised his voice. All troops in frontier districts must be placed on full battle alert. Didn't they send the deserter on purpose to provoke us? Said Stalin. It might still be possible to settle the situation by peaceful means. The magnates now spoke up diffidently, agreeing with the generals that the troops had to be put on alert just in case. Stalin nodded at the generals, who hurried next door to Paskuryobyshev's office to draft the order. When they returned, Stalin watered it down. The generals rushed back to the defense commissariat to transmit the order. A surprise attack by the Germans is possible. Our forces are to refrain from any kind of provocative action. At 11, the leaders moved upstairs to Stalin's apartment. Stalin kept reassuring us that Hitler would not begin the war, claimed Mikoyan. Zhukov phoned again at 12:30. A third deserter, a communist laborer from Berlin named Alfred Liskov, had swum the river Pruth to report that the order to invade had been read to his unit. Stalin checked that the high alert order was being transmitted, then commanded that Liskov should be shot for his disinformation. Even on such a night, it was impossible to break the Stalinist routine of brutality and entertainment. The Politburo headed out to Kuntsevo in a convoy of limousines. The generals, watched by Mechlis, remained tensely in the defense commissariat. Molotov drove to the foreign commissariat to send a final telegram to Dekanozov in Berlin, who was already trying to get through to Ribbentrop to put the questions Schulenburg had failed to answer. Molotov then joined the others at Kuntsevo. We might even have watched a film, he said. At around 2 a.m., after an hour or so of dining, drinking and talking, they headed back to their Kremlin apartments. Far away, all along the Soviet border, the Luftwaffe bombers were heading for their targets. 3 million of Hitler's soldiers were crossing the border to engage the Soviet forces of almost equal strength. The greatest war of all time was about to begin. A duel between two brutal and reckless egomaniacs. And both were probably asleep. Stalin had retired when Marshal Zhukov called Kuntsevo. Please connect me to Comrade Stalin. It's urgent. Comrade Stalin, sleeping. Wake him immediately, Zhukov told the duty officer. The Germans are bombing our cities. There was silence. Zhukov waited for what seemed like an eternity. He was not the only one trying to report the invasion to Stalin. Admiral Kuznetsov had phoned the Kremlin. I request you to inform Comrade Stalin that German planes are bombing Sebastopol. This is war. I shall report it to the proper person. A few minutes later, the admiral discovered who the proper person was. Malenkov called, asking in an irritated voice, Do you understand what you're reporting? Even as German bombers strafed Kiev and Sebastopol and German troops crossed the borders, Stalin's courtiers were still trying to bully away reality. When Timoshenko was called by the deputy commander of the Western Special Military District, Boldin, frantically reporting that the Germans were advancing, Timoshenko ordered him not to react. What do you mean? Shouted Boldin. Our troops are retreating, towns are in flames, people are dying. His reply was, Josef Vissarionovich believes this could be a provocation by some German generals. Zhukov was still waiting on the line to Kuntsevo as Stalin was roused. When he came to the phone, Zhukov reported and asked permission to counterattack. There was silence. He could just hear Stalin breathing. Did you understand me? Asked Zhukov. Comrade Stalin? He could still only hear heavy breathing. Then Stalin spoke. Bring Timoshenko to the Kremlin. Tell Paskuryobyshev to summon the Politburo. Stalin sped into town, where the Politburo meeting started just over an hour after the full German attack. Mikoyan thought Stalin was subdued. Others thought him pale, bewildered, and depressed. But he was in command of his office, at least. Elsewhere, the fronts were in anarchy. Stalin spoke slowly, choosing his words carefully. Occasionally his voice broke down. When he had finished, everybody was silent for some time. Amazingly, he still persisted in the idea that the war might be a provocation by the German officers.
Hitler simply does not know about it.
Stalin would not order resistance until he had heard from Berlin. That scoundrel Ribbentrop tricked us, he said to Mikoyan, still not blaming Hitler. We have to call the German embassy immediately. Schulenburg arrived in Molotov's office for the second time that night. The Kremlin was bathed in the first summer light and fragrant with the acacias and roses of the Alexandrovsky Gardens. Schulenburg read out the telegram that had arrived from Berlin. The concentrations of Soviet forces had forced the Reich to take military countermeasures. Molotov's face twitched with disbelief and anger. Finally, he stammered, "Is this supposed to be a declaration of war?" Schulenburg could not speak either. He shrugged sadly. Molotov's anger overcame his shock. "The message I have just been given couldn't mean anything but a declaration of war, since German troops have already crossed the border and Soviet cities, like Odessa, Kiev, and Minsk, have been bombed by German aircraft for an hour and a half." Molotov was shouting now. This was a breach of confidence unprecedented in history. Surely we haven't deserved that. There was nothing more to say. Schulenburg shook hands and departed. Molotov rushed to Stalin's office, where he announced, "Germany's declared war on us." Stalin subsided into his chair, lost in thought. The silence was long and pregnant. Then he roused himself with a wildly optimistic slogan, "The enemy will be beaten all along the line." And he turned to the generals. "What do you recommend?" Zhukov suggested that the frontier districts must hold up the Germans. "Annihilate," interrupted Dymashenko, "not hold up." "Issue a directive," said Stalin. "Do not cross the border." He persisted in clinging to the hope that he could settle things diplomatically. No one dared contradict this absurdity except Molotov, his comrade since 1912. "No," replied Molotov emphatically. "It was war, and nothing could be done about it." By midday, the scale of the invasion and Molotov's stark insistence had shaken the reality into Stalin. The Soviet Western Front was shattered, and the counterattack tossed aside as the panzers charged towards Minsk and the road to Moscow. Everyone agreed that the government had to announce the war. Stalin refused to do it himself. "Let Molotov speak." The entourage disagreed. Surely the people would not understand why they were not hearing from the Vorst. Stalin insisted that he would speak another time. "He didn't want to be first to speak," recalled Molotov. "He needed a clear picture. He couldn't respond like an automaton to everything. He was a human being, after all." Molotov mastered his stammer and delivered a famous speech, largely drafted by Stalin, in a flat but quavering voice. "Our cause is just. The enemy will be crushed. Victory will be ours."